lot of times, but that's what the founders of the Constitution wanted. And Representative Capster, I've got to agree with her point. The turnover rate in the small schools in the state is phenomenal. It's terrible for kids. You have teachers who go out there from Minnesota and Wisconsin and New York who've never been in the community, and they leave as quick as they can. And that is, those are not the jurors that I think the constitutional founders intended to have. Certainly they're allowed to be on a jury, but the whole point was you're supposed to have a jury from your community. And so I think that does militate in favor of the bill. Though I guess I had some questions.
I understand
that that's the problem in the very small schools in the small villages. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem in a bigger community like Kotzebue? That do you have a substantial number of teachers who come through the school and don't last very long? Or?
Out of 28 teachers this year, we're losing 10 in my school. For the second, 2 years ago, it was the same. We lost half of our staff 2 years ago. It's all the time.
Madam Chair.
Are
those teachers who are retiring, or are those teachers who just are young teachers who just don't stay very long?
A lot of them are young teachers not staying long. We have a lot of politics in the district that just wipes teachers out periodically.
And I guess the only comment I would make is especially in the small school, I agree with the bill. We've now created the sort of monster of a federal law that does what it does, and we can't do anything about it. But for the schools that don't meet adequate yearly progress, there are severe ramifications for those schools. So I think the bill makes sense. I would go further, though. I don't think that there would be support in the legislature. So I wouldn't push it. But I would go further and say we should also exempt teachers in schools that are not on the road system, because those are teachers that are the teachers like the ones we just discussed, teachers who don't stay very long, whose presence is completely important to the kids in those communities, who can't be replaced by a sub in those communities. But I think that might hurt the bill's chances of passing.
Representative Samuels, and then Ogg, and then Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd follow up on what Governor Garrett asked or stated. I wouldn't go as far as off the road system, because I frankly think Kotzebue and Barrow and Mackinac, Gillingham, they ought to be included. But I'd support it, and I don't want to mess with your bill right now. But on the floor, if you came up with a floor, whether they pass the adequate yearly progress or not, if you lose the teacher in Shafornak, especially for grand jury, what are you going to do? Doesn't matter if they're meeting it then, they're probably not going to meet it the next go around. So I'd support something on the floor if you came up with some kind of a floor. I disagree with letting the teachers in Dillingham or letting you off the hook. I disagree with that. If you've got 28 teachers there, they'll find a way, and there's enough people that they can sub, and you can make do the same as they have to do in any community. But in the true villages, I would support just tentative, although, and we will not get into the discussion, Representative Guerra. On jury awards in rural Alaska and the reasons for them.
Just on that point, and then I'll get to those. Maybe, Mary, you could think about 3 teachers or less, or 5 teachers or less, or something. So rather than looking at the community itself, it's the impact that pulling one out would have.
Yeah,
coming
can.
Up with a number.
Okay.
Just a thought.
And it's up to you.
Yeah. Representative Ogg, Gruenberg, and then Holm.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just would have to disagree with Representative Guerra. I think that teachers are part of the community, and we, as legislators, should recognize that. We shouldn't be going down a road saying that when we ask people to come to this state, or we encourage them to come and participate in education process by being teachers, that they are not part of the community. And so I just can't go along with that line of thought. I think the bill's a good one. It recognizes some paucity and the ability to draw jurors in small areas, which causes a restriction in trying to provide services. But I just can't agree with you. I think that when we ask people to come to this state and to become teachers and professionals in our smaller communities and off the road system, that they are part of that community, and we should recognize that.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, I have 3 things. First of all, unless you have a serious problem, Representative Capster, I'm going to offer an amendment to tighten the title. this is a barn door title.
Okay.
Secondly, I'm just serving notice to my acquaintance back there, Mr. Woolover. I'm going to be interested in the proposed change of may to shall, what the impact will be on the court system. And so I will ask Madam Chair for that. I could come up and testify on that. And finally, I just want to put on the record that there are two schools in Anchorage that are on Tier 2. One of them is the Whaley Center, which obviously has problems making yearly progress. I think, by the way, that's a terrible provision in the No Child Gets Left Behind Act. And the other is Mountain View School in my district.
Yeah.
And so the way this bill is written now, it will apply to Mountain View School. I support the bill because I think we need to keep our people in Mountain View School teaching. But I want you to know that it does apply to one school in Anchorage, and I suspect that next year it'll apply to more schools in Anchorage because of the way the bill's drafted, using the phrase, quote, fail to make adequate yearly progress under the public law. It sounds to me like this is a problem that doesn't have anything to do with that public law. It's a problem that has to do with the lack of substitute teachers in rural areas. And it sounds like you have a problem. I'm not certain that this bill is addressed as it ought to be to get at that specific problem, because it may include schools like Mountain View that they can get substitute teachers for, and it may not include schools in other rural areas that are making adequate progress, but that they can't get substitutes for.
While the chair and the vice chair are absent, I'm going to take the liberty to respond to that just for a moment.
Yeah, well, we continue. We march right along.
Okay, are you the second vice chair?
Okay. I got the gal in my hand.
Yeah, we're still
okay, Mr. Samuel. I had the pleasure and distinction of serving as a substitute teacher for 1 year in Bethel. And one of the things that I was very surprised to find out is how many students' lives are extremely disrupted when the teacher is out of the classroom. Typically, these are the students who their teacher is the only thing that stays constant in their life on a daily basis, you know, in 1 year. Maybe that teacher changes every year. But what I noticed is in almost every class that I taught, there was one student that was extremely emotionally disturbed, and that was really brought out when their teacher was gone. And I think that this is especially true in schools that are not meeting adequate yearly progress. There's something else going on that's not just the fault of the school, but I think that something else is missing in their home life and in their community. So I think that any school that is not meeting adequate yearly progress probably has some element of the teacher really needing to be there every day.
Representative Guerra.
Before we start coming up with great ways to rewrite the bill,
I'm not offering.
All of us have come up with ideas, but the truth is, you know, sometimes we solve a small portion of the problem because that's the feasible problem to solve. And I can imagine that many of us have considered, well, there are lots of other schools where maybe teachers shouldn't serve as jurors, conceivably. But the class of those schools is going to be very hard to define. So small schools, yeah, what if it's a small school like a small school in Anchorage? Do we want it to apply to that? Or maybe small school is not the right definition. Maybe it's off the road system. But Representative Samuels made the argument, a good argument, that, well, that's maybe too overbroad. And so, you know, the courts frequently say that it's not a bill is not flawed just because it aims to solve a smaller part of a problem when it conceivably could have solved a larger problem. And as we sit here, I bet you the new ideas that we're coming up for the bill are ideas that Representative Kapsner has thought about and decided perhaps they're too difficult to define in a way that you can feasibly do it. And Representative Ogden, I don't disagree with you. Teachers are part of the community, and they're a needed part, and frankly, they're a part of the community that decides to come to a community for less money than they're worth to do an important social service. Sometimes we talk in script in this committee to try and keep the comments shorter rather than longer, but what I meant to say is, in balancing whether or not we're going to let people off the hook for being a juror, there is an increased argument for saying, well, maybe there are some points that would justify us focusing on this group of people and saying, when we leave them from the duty of jury duty, it might be okay. But I certainly consider teachers part of any community they decide to reside in. I mean, it's just amazing thing that there are people in this community who will work for less money than they're worth to do a social service and then get vilified for it. I didn't mean to suggest what maybe I did suggest in trying to talk in shorthand. That's it.
I'd like to offer an amendment to change the second May on line 5 to shall and the word year to term on line 6, page 1, the same debate.
Oh, you're just asking.
I'd like to offer the amendment.
I'll offer that amendment.
Thank you. The amendment's on the table. I assume you object.
That number 1?
Yeah, and I would like
Mr. Oliver.
Mr. Williver.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, could Representative Capster join us?
Certainly.
To the substitute vice chair, for the record, my name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska Court System. Just to answer the question, on this amendment changing the second May to shall, I don't see a particular problem for the court system. In fact, in some administrative ways, it's easier if it's a blanket exemption rather than a judicial determination. But it's a policy call for legislation. In Anchorage and larger communities, jury clerks handle most of these issues. In the smaller communities, these issues are dealt with by the judge. But it's from our perspective that either option is workable.
Okay. Any questions?
Well, I remove my objection.
Are there any other objection to the amendment? Hearing none, the amendment passes. Any other discussion on the bill itself? Governor Grimberg.
Yes, I take it there's nobody else to testify.
That is correct.
Oh, okay.
Although a motion to adopt the version, the D version, would be
I'll move that.
In order. Okay. Any objection to that? Okay. Continue.
Yeah, I move to tighten the title, and I'd ask that to be a conceptual amendment confined to the specific subject of the bill. As narrowly as we can do it, I'd ask Vanessa Tondini, the famous judiciary
yes.
counsel, to
do that. Is there any objection to that? Representative Capstern, is okay to tighten the title up?
Fine by me.
Hearing none, we'll tighten the title. Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions, I guess, and they go to the constitutionality of what we're doing here. And because I'm not a lawyer, and there's five in the room, and
you say it like it's a bad word.
Not too bright here when it comes to this type of stuff, but let's talk about a few things. What is the jury of your peers? What does that mean? I looked up in Black's dictionary, and what it says is it's equal. Those who are a man's equal in rank and station, thus trial by jury of his peers means a trial by jury of citizens. Okay, it doesn't say... depending upon your station in life, or whether you're a teacher or a truck driver or whatever. And I understand what you're trying to get to. I'm trying to make some sense out of what we're saying. And when Representative Anderson was talking about the fact that one of the teachers felt that they'd been inadvertently treated by a jury because they couldn't get what they called a jury of his peers, in such an environment, it was most damaging to his justice, or justice wasn't served. Also, what's the constant, because I'm wondering about a blanket exemption, is a blanket exemption a constitutionally accepted practice for jurors? Could you constitutionally just accept jurors, depending upon whether they were black, green, purple, truck drivers, teachers, or whatever? I just have some questions that other folks here, much brighter than I am, are going to tell me, I'm sure. Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Let me go through a couple more.
I'm sorry.
this is a law of exclusion, not inclusion. And I question if we as American citizens or U.S. citizens should be doing these things. Are we saying that we have polarized groups within within the United States that cannot be peers? What about the right to serve on a jury? Does a teacher not have a right to serve on a jury or a duty of stewardship to be a juror? Are we limiting one person's right to the benefit of another person's right here? I don't know, but these are the kinds of things that are kind of rolling through my head here. And the reason I say that is I've lived in Fairbanks all my life. But there's a great number of folks that haven't. So somebody comes from California, they have a whole different set of background rules that they've lived by, but they could sit on my jury, could they not? Are they a peer? Well, one could argue, given this kind of a scenario, that they're either not a peer or they are a peer, but I don't have any answer for this. And so I'm trying to make some sense of it in terms of policy. Is it good state policy for us to have different rules for people that live in Antioch or people that live in Fairbanks or in Juneau when it comes to justice? I'll leave it at that.
May I touch on some of the questions?
Representative Castro.
Okay, just to start off with, through the chair, Representative Holm, my intent was not to make this a regional issue. This is something that's brought about as a result of No Child Left Behind and adequate yearly progress. What we're saying is that under the conditions that teachers are teaching in now, under the conditions that students are learning in schools, with exorbitant overhead, with few classroom tools, with a lot of testing going on, a lot of people ill-prepared for tests, a myriad of other challenges that schools are faced, I think this would be a good effort for the legislature, or a good policy or something that we can give the school, saying this didn't cost us anything, this is going to provide more classroom hours for you, less of a burden for you to be paying teachers for doing a lot of work in preparation time and serving on injuries and away from their classroom, the travel expenses, and the expense of getting other people lined up in their communities to serve as substitute teachers if that need should arise. And this could happen in Fairbanks. I'm not sure if you know how many schools in your community are not meeting adequate yearly progress, but I'm sure that when and if this bill is passed, Representative Holm, many teachers in your community will say, thank you for helping me do my job under these very trying times. And as I said at the outset, this is a temporary solution to a temporary problem, hopefully. Hopefully we get to the point where 100% of our schools are meeting adequate yearly progress. The conversation of jury of peers was merely as an aside.
Yeah.
And that is not the heart of the bill, and I am nervous about going down that path. And we could spend many hours talking about jury of peers, and I could tell you specific cases where trials have been won because all the jurors understood that every person in a village has a different smell depending on what family they come from, depending on the kind of meat they eat or greens that they pick, that perhaps somebody not from that area would understand or wouldn't understand. So, but I don't want to go down that path. I want to talk about adequate yearly progress, highly qualified teachers, and helping schools meet those needs.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, with all due respect, I understand your reluctance to go down that path, but I do have a great question for the constitutionality of taking the rights of a person to be a juror or the rights of a person to request a juror of a different race if they so decided or whatever. So I appreciate what you're saying to me, and I appreciate the reason for it, but I sometimes wonder and question if we should pass policy over the whole state, policy decisions, based upon a small circumstance.
Now, I know it's not small in your district, and I respect that, and I understand it completely. And there's two schools in my district as well, that I know of, that they don't meet up. But I'm having trouble with this in the sense that we're, I look at being a juror as being a steward. When you're a juror, you're actually giving something back to society. It's your payment to society for what you're doing. I mean, it's just one of the things that we do for being a member of society. And I know what you're trying to get to here, but I have a problem with saying that being a juror is not an inalienable right, because I think to act as a juror is your right, as a peer.
Okay, under Surely. The bill, Madam Chairman, you may serve if you're compelled to serve. There is nothing that excludes you or discriminates.
It says shall exclude, though, I believe.
But judges and clerks have the discretion to allow teachers or even force teachers, even as the bill stands, if my understanding is correct, Mr. Wolver.
Mr. Wolver?
One
place for discretion that I see at the outset is that a person may claim the exemption. So a person isn't required to claim the exemption. I mean, that's their choice. If they felt compelled by the civic duty that Representative Holm has discussed, then they don't have to. But then just clarify for us what happens at that next step.
To the chair, that's correct. The first may in the sentence, as I read the statute, I wasn't involved in drafting this, but the first may gives to the teacher to elect whether or not he or she wants to ask for this exemption. And then if the teacher says, I would like to be exempt under this provision, then they're exempt. And there isn't discretion at that point to say, no, you must. And that'll be the end of it. You would be exempt just as if you were exempt for any of the other reasons that the statutes provide.
Would you please go under some of the other exemptions that are provided?
Well, through the chair, Representative Capser, currently the only exemption is, well, the exemption in terms if you're otherwise qualified is only for judges. Prior to 1982, we had exemptions for judges, attorneys, ministers, priests, doctors, physicians, mm-hmm. dentists, and then any other civil officer for whom jury, federal or state civil officer, for whom jury duty would be inconsistent with their duties. We used to have lots of exemptions. Right now, we only have judges.
How come legislators are never called?
I
was called.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
I made the mistake of saying, I really want to be on this jury, and they opened their eyes and they said, we don't like you.
You were called.
Called
and you
summer.
Could even be called during the session.
I've been called during May.
I don't think you can.
Yeah. You can be called during the session. You would then respond and say, I can't do it, but please call me again in the summer, and then they call you in the summer.
Yeah, I can show you my notice. I've got a notice I need to mail out.
Wow. All right. I'm going to go to Representative Guerra and then Gruenberg, but I think Representative Capser is right and would encourage you. Is this your last hearing on the floor?
Yes.
Probably easier not to go down the other path just because it does conjure up a lot of opinions.
There's two more housekeeping measures that need
okay.
to be taken up.
But you know, not the least of which is women couldn't even be on a jury many years ago, more or less chair of committee talking about juries. So whatever, we could spend a lot of time talking about it. I think what's important is for us to focus on whether it's the appropriate policy to allow for an exemption for a teacher in a school that has failed to make annual yearly progress, regardless of whether it's rural or urban. So let's stay focused on where we are and get through the housekeeping measures. And I have Representative Guerra and then Gruenberg on the list. Thank you, Mr. Wolver. Representative Guerra.
thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Holm makes good points. Representative Capser makes good points. Representative Holm's question was whether it's constitutional to allow certain people to avoid jury service. And it is constitutional. In the federal courts, they still do it. In the federal courts, they... No, I think it's in part because the judges there are appointed for life and don't have the judicial council process to go through, and so I think they tend to be less receptive to public pressure in not so good ways. But in the federal courts, the judges, they exempt doctors, lawyers, and lots of other people. I think that's absurd, frankly, because, you know, the beautiful thing about, and this is Representative Holmes' point, the beautiful thing about jury service is, as a presumably important person, you go into the jury pool and all of a sudden you realize that everybody else is just as important as you, and jury service is just as inconvenient for them as it is for you, even though you're a doctor or a lawyer. But what we're doing here is we're making a policy call. We can make the policy call. It is constitutional. We're making a policy call that that this is such an important issue that we're willing to sort of do what the federal courts do and grant an exemption to a certain class of people. It's a narrow class of people. Hopefully it is temporary. The president promises we won't have any schools that fail adequate yearly progress in 10 years. realistically, it's probably not such a temporary problem.
Well, it's progressive. What he's trying to speak for sure.
Yeah. It just makes sense to me. If I felt we could get it through the legislature, I would probably say just in the smaller communities, because that's where the problem is more acute. But I think that'll draw objections from folks for various policy reasons. So I'm supportive of the bill.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Garris said a lot of what I wanted to say. I kind of wanted to answer Representative Holmes' questions. I was just looking in the annotations that the chair has in front of her there. There are cases that say that legislature can enact the subject of the jury's qualifications or disqualifications, for that matter. The only thing you can't do is, like, say no women can be on a jury or something like that. There's a case that says that, or something similar. But there is a provision in Alaska law that says you have to be able to read and speak the English language.
That's true. You do, yeah.
That's in statute. And the only other thing I wanted to say about the exclusion of doctors and lawyers, Representative Hall, is that the requirement, if you're on trial, is that they be your peer, not that you be theirs.
That's true.
That's a good point.
Good point.
Okay, on that interesting path that we went down, let's come back to the bill. And
can we talk about how this interplays with the tort reform bill?
No, we can't. Yeah. So, what are the two housekeeping measures that you have, Representative Capstone?
Is we passed it to you. It's where it says it found.
Is this the page one, line 7?
Yeah.
That is designated as.
That has failed to make adequate yearly progress. Wait, line 7?
Yeah.
And that needs to be changed to designated.
So what I have here would be
designated.
Page 1, line 7 would say a school that is designated as failing to make.
Yeah, is designated as failing to make.
Okay. So the Representative Samuels, what amendment number is that?
We're on 3 right now.
Okay. So amendment number 3, I'll offer it on behalf of Representative Capstone. Page 1, line 7, following the word that, we would add is designated as failing to make and strike the words has failed. Is there any objection to amendment number 3? Hearing none, amendment number 3 carries. Any further amendments?
Amendment number 4 would be to replace school year with school term. That one's done. Okay.
No.
Yeah, amendment number 1.
Okay.
Both shall and amendment 1.
That was
shall
and
term.
Replace both.
Madam Secretary, the members of the committee are saying that amendment number 1 did two things. It changed may to shall, the second may on line 5, and it changed on line 6, school year to school term.
So that's what amendment 1 shall be? Thanks.
Yes. Okay, so are there any further amendments to House Bill 353? Is there any further testimony from anyone in the audience? Is there any further testimony from anyone online? Is there any further committee discussion? Representative Grunberg.
Move the bill without the new judiciary CS without with fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Okay. Bill is amended with 2-0 fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, House Bill 353 is moved. Thank you, Representative Capstone. Okay, that brings us to House Bill 244.
I move HB 244.
Is there any objection to that motion?
Two forty-four moves with individual.
So moved.
Okay, that takes care of that.
Okay.
Could you imagine? That actually sounded legitimate.
What's 244? It's a crime package.
It's a crime package.
Crime package. 244. I withdraw the motion in case anybody thought it was possible.
Okay, this is what he needs.
You should have voted.
Yeah, but just that. He wants to make sure that we.
It is 3:40, and we are going to spend the rest of our time on House Bill 244. Now, what I'm going to go ahead and do, I promised Barbara Brink that I would pick up with her testimony. Then I'm going to go to my good friend Josh Fink. Then I'm going to go, I see that Lieutenant Storey is on the line for questions only. And Deputy Chief Holloway from the Anchorage Police Force is also on for questions only. So Barbara, and then Josh, and then we will go ahead and get back to the bill with the Department of Law. Barbara Brink, are you there?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I am here.
Please can testify.
Thank you.
Do something.
My name is Barbara Brink. I'm the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. I've been a public defender here in Alaska for over 21 years. I have some thoughts to offer regarding this bill, and for the ease of the members of the committee, I'll go through them chronologically as they're laid out in the bill, because I found that jumping around became confusing to me. So this is not in the order of my priorities, but I'll make my priorities clear. First of all, I'd like to point out that Section 5, Paragraph 3, makes it a felony crime for a person to provide alcohol to a minor if it is within the boundaries of a local option area. You know, that certainly is a policy call that is certainly within the purview of the legislature, but I just wanted to note what I see will be a huge racially disparate impact on Alaska Native citizens, because they are the people that live in the areas that have established the local option law. And a lot of times you're going to be dealing with young people, a 21-year-old giving or sharing a beer with his nephew who's 20 years old. All of a sudden we've made that a felony, and we're going to punish that person with a felony conviction. And I don't know that we're thinking about all the possible ways in which a felony conviction can hurt somebody. Then I would like to move to...
Madam Chair? Ms. Brink, this is Max Gruenberg. I did not understand what you just said. Somebody sharing something with somebody and it makes them a felony? I just didn't
21-year-old.
24, I believe, what we're talking about.
Hello?
Madam Chair, through the Chair, thank you, Representative Gruenberg. My concern is I want to make sure I'm working from the same CF that you are. I believe I am. If I am, I'm talking about Section 5 on page 3.
Yeah, right. I'm with you there. It looks to me...
The line, please.
That you said somebody sharing something...
24.
Yeah, you said somebody was sharing something with his nephew.
A beer or something.
Oh, a beer?
Yes.
You're saying that if somebody shared a beer with his underage nephew.
Yes. Section 416.051 has to do with furnishing or delivery of alcohol to a person under the age of 21.
Yep.
What we're doing in Section 5 is we're making that a felony if it's happening within a municipality or the perimeter of an established village that has adopted a local option
Meaning they're dry.
Thank you.
Or
thank you, Ms. Brink.
But the critical part about that, we'll let the AG respond, though, Barbara, is I think that if the village has decided to be damp or dry, they've already gone down that public policy route for all of the reasons that we understand, it's that more egregious that somebody would provide alcohol to someone under 21.
Madam Chair, yes, I understand. And I have a thing, my comment has to do with, is it so egregious that we want to make that a felony for someone in that village, and that those felony convictions will disparately impact Alaska Natives in those local option areas?
Okay. I follow you. Thank you, Barbara.
Okay. The next section I wanted to comment was section 6, the forfeiture provisions. I don't have any comments about specifics in the bill. There was a lot of discussion at the last hearing about how forfeiture works, and I just wanted to affirm for those members that had questions is that the way forfeiture works is, yes, the police seize property or money first and ask questions later. Mm-hmm. And frankly, they seize everything on a person. So if my client is arrested and charged with sharing a beer, they will take all the money in his possession at the time he is cited or arrested and put that into the state's evidence locker, and it will be difficult for that person to get that money back. Not only can the state then forfeit it, but frankly, a lot of times the prosecutor's office makes it a requirement if you want to work out a plea agreement or a settlement of the case without going to trial, the state will often require forfeiture of that property without a forfeiture proceeding in order to give you any concessions on the charges. So.
Representative Groomberg?
Yeah, Ms. Brink, I tried to reach you on the phone last night about, and you too, Mr. Fink, if you're on the phone, about the tobacco tax bill that's up in Ways and Means and the forfeiture provisions in there. I'd be grateful if you guys could call my office if you have a time this afternoon to discuss that. Extension 4940 and Joe McKinnon. I'm talking to you now since I couldn't reach you yesterday.
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg, I did get your message, but I didn't have time to call you yesterday. We had hearings all day. I'd be happy to call you if we're finished here. I have to say, though, public defenders, public advocates are not the best experts on forfeiture because, frankly, most of our clients do not have assets that are seized in the forfeiture proceeding. But I'd be happy to talk with you about that later.
Yeah, or Mr. McKinnon if I'm not there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to move along to Section 8. Offer my observation. This is the section where we're amending the murder in the second degree statute to make a person guilty of murder in the second degree, even if a participant in the felony crime was killed during that. And we have some discussion about what the policy behind that was, and I just wanted to offer my 2 cents on that. I think the policy behind not including the participant previously was that if you engaged this woman with conduct, you somehow had assumed the risk that things could go wrong, and therefore your life was valued less seriously. So this section, which I don't have a whole lot of disagreement with, just makes it so a participant getting killed during a felony murder can also result in felony murder charges. But I will bring up Section 8 later when I'm talking about Section 13 because those seem a little inconsistent. The first section I'd like to talk about in depth is Section Number 9. Section 9 is on page 6, starting at about line 6, and what it does is takes a crime of with criminal negligence causing serious physical injury to another person by means of a dangerous instrument, and we're moving that from Assault 4, a Class A misdemeanor, Assault 3, which is a Class C felony. And I appreciate the desire to bring harsher consequences to those are drinking but are not under the influence of alcohol but somehow are related in automobile accidents. But I would like to suggest that if that is our purpose, we are drafting this bill far too broadly because there's nothing in this statute that requires any alcohol whatsoever to have even been consumed. And I believe that we'll have some unintended people falling under the rubric of this crime. I mean, in a moment's hesitation, as you're driving, I think we've all maybe missed a stop sign. If there's black ice on the road, we don't see it, and we're traveling too fast for conditions and result in an accident, it could be felonious level conduct. If you've got naughty kids in the backseat who distract you while you're trying to get them to school, you miss to be charged with felony level conduct. I don't think it's necessary. I think the current state of the law is recklessly caused serious physical injury by means of will be guilty of a felony. And frankly, it is very easy to prove recklessness once you tell that jury there's been drinking going on. I can't imagine that a jury in the state would not find reckless behavior if someone has been drinking and causes a car accident.
So, Barbara, you're suggesting that you change the mental intent to reckless as opposed to with criminal negligence.
It's already a felony to cause serious physical injury to another person by means of a dangerous instrument. It's already, I think it's actually assault in the second degree, not just assault in the third degree. So frankly, my suggestion would be to omit that change in paragraph 4 in its entirety.
What
if someone's drinking, I think the state can prove reckless conduct, and they're already liable for a felony.
Okay.
And recklessly causing serious physical injury by means of a dangerous a felony.
Sorry.
A mandatory presumptive.
I think she's cutting out.
Are you there, Barbara?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Hear me now?
Yes.
All right. I think that we should think twice about making felons out of people who make careless but still innocent mistakes. And certainly if our goal is to get at people have consumed alcohol, we should at the very least include that requirement in that section.
Barbara, how many cases have you seen where somebody has been charged with criminal negligence while they were turning around in the back seat, their kids arguing on the way to school, or, you know, the hypotheticals that you gave? How often is somebody charged with assault in those circumstances? I mean, or is it even alleged?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry that our case management system doesn't allow us to break down case categories with that kind of a detail, but I can tell you when I handled misdemeanors, which was a long time ago in the early 80s, we did see people charged with assault in the fourth degree without having consumed any level of alcohol. And I think Mr. Fink might have some examples when he testifies of cases that he has seen.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next section I would like to talk about is Section 12, which makes it a crime if a third-party custodian fails to immediately notify about a violation when acting as a third-party custodian. And I just want to give a little background about third-party custodians. Third-party custodians originated as an idea to help poor people get out on bail when they had absolutely no money for bail. A third-party custodian is like a substitute jailer. A person has to come to court. They have to promise the judge they will watch this person, most often watch this person 24 hours a day, that they will insist that every condition that the judge orders be followed, and that they agree to promise to turn in immediately somebody who violates those conditions. The problem is that system has evolved into a requirement in practically every case, not only as a substitute for money bail, but in addition to money bail. And now people on even low-level misdemeanors are being held in jail because they have no friend or relative who can take them off work and watch them 24 hours a day. I think it's clear what this section is, that now even fewer people will be able to be third-party custodians because these people are not well-versed in the law. To be a third-party custodian, you pretty much have to have no criminal record and not much experience. And so when they come to court and hear that they are now subject to being charged with a crime, I can tell you that that information isn't going to be clear enough to them that, you know, this is really only a serious problem if you're not going to do your duties. I think it's just going to dissuade more and more people from acting as third-party custodians for poor people. And frankly, that's already happening. The Alaska Judicial Council just prepared a report on Alaska felony processes, looking at 1999, and I'm pretty certain that they sent copies of this report to everyone in the legislature, but it already confirmed that public defender clients, poor clients, are time incarcerated pretrial than other clients. And it also confirmed that third-party custodians were a huge reason why people spend more time incarcerated. It's going to have a huge chilling effect on people's willingness to come forward and be third parties. And what that means is going to result in more and more people spending more and more time in custody before they're ever convicted. These are all pretrial people. Pretrial people who are entitled to be presumed innocent, and yet they're sitting in jail because they can't come up with a third party custodian.
Barbara, any ideas? I mean, you're talking about the result, I guess, down the line, but the actual cause of it, it sounds like, is that in more and more cases, the requirement for a third-party custodian is being implemented or exacted, and even in misdemeanor cases. Why is that trend occurring?
And I'm sure I wish I could explain it. I've asked judges to explain it. I don't know why. I can't explain it. And frankly, people are already somewhat reluctant to be third parties because, frankly, they are advised that they could be subject to contempt of court if they don't follow all the conditions to the letter. And, you know, I would have to disagree with the testimony that the contempt process is a cumbersome process. You file a one-page order to show cause why this person should not be held in contempt. And I've seen it done in bail cases. I think that the prosecutor's office, rightly so, limits their prosecutions of these people to cases where they think there really was a deliberate failure. But since they already can be prosecuted, and since it's already so difficult to find third parties, I just don't think we need to criminalize yet another act in the state of Alaska.
And then just a final thought, and then I would be more inclined to say that you should have this, and that if somebody is going to be a third-party custodian, that they ought to take it very, very seriously, because as you said, they are by extension a jailer. What does pique my curiosity, and I'd be more interested in asking questions or discovering, is why third-party custodians are being required in addition to bail in more and more cases, even misdemeanor cases. Seems to me like that's the problem you focus on. You focus on saying you don't just throw third-party custodian, responsibility out. You really mean to say this person is a threat, either a threat of flight or a threat to society without a third-party custodian. But that third-party custodian ought to believe right down to the bottom of their soul that what they are doing is very serious. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm concerned about the logic process here. I don't think that the answer is to not implement stronger measures for the third-party custodian simply because judges are perhaps inappropriately requiring third-party custodians in situations where maybe they shouldn't. If the original intent was to help poor people who might not be able to come up with bail monies, why on earth then would you be requiring it in misdemeanor cases in addition to a bail? I don't know the answer, but.
Madam Chair, I agree. I don't know the answer either. I know from having represented clients for years that it's really difficult to find a third-party custodian. And frankly, the public defender has an informal agreement, at least in Anchorage, that we will not even put a case on for a bail hearing until we have talked to that third party. We have let them know all the rules and the serious repercussions that could happen. And then the third party in court is reminded of that again. And then to reemphasize that, they have to sign a document that states that they understand that. The third party document paper has on there that they can be charged with contempt. So I frankly think there is a strong effort to convince the third party that this is a very important obligation and it's critical to the process and that they will be prosecuted with contempt if they violate. I just fear it's so hard to find a third party that this will just make it harder.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kira.
Yeah. Two points. One, Barb, I guess this is Les Guerra speaking. I guess I'm still not so clear. I mean, I agree that third-party custodians are overused, and I'll address that point next. But if it's already a crime for somebody for a third-party custodian to violate their duties, if it's already criminal contempt, then what is wrong with just why does it make things worse to just come up with a different misdemeanor that you're going to charge instead of criminal contempt? How does that deter third-party custodians if they're already being told that a violation may constitute a crime?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, this raises this to the level of punishment and crime. Contempt can be punished by a fine of up to $300 and a sentence of up to 6 months in jail. This raises it to a Class A misdemeanor, which carries with it a potential punishment for up to a year in jail and up to a $10,000 fine.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Though, you know, I've made this argument before in different contexts. Somebody who is willing to commit a crime probably doesn't think about the full extent of the penalties. I don't think that anybody's going to, I mean, make the argument to me why somebody might now say, well, it's only $300 in 6 months, but God, when it becomes $1,000 in a year, that's going to change my mind. I mean, I don't think that people think like that, but can you convince me otherwise?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, what we're talking about are people who are making a huge sacrifice already in their lives. And even if they love the person, even if they support them, they're already somewhat reluctant and on the fence of whether or not, in addition to their daily responsibilities in life, they want to take on this huge obligation. And these aren't people who commit crimes. These aren't people who are not thoughtful. These are actually people who think about consequences and think about whether or not this is going to have a huge impact and will listen very carefully to what the judge is saying. And the judge will have to advise them of what the maximum penalties might be. And as I said, these are people who are not very well versed in the criminal law. And, you know, it'll just increase their level of not wishing to get involved because it's all kind of too scary.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
So here's the other point, and I would rather have a world where we used fewer third-party custodians, but I guess I'm still not so convinced about the difference between criminal contempt and a misdemeanor. I'll still think about that. But is there a, I mean, I'll say for the other members of the committee, third-party custodians are imposed only in cases where the prosecution asks for them, but some prosecutors, especially younger prosecutors, who I have found ask for them almost routinely. And I think lawyers, regardless of which side they work on, sometimes maybe overuse the authority that's vested in them as attorneys, and whether they're defense attorneys, prosecution attorneys, civil defense plaintiffs, whatever, sometimes overuse the power that's vested in them, and you get some people, I think, that over ask for third-party custodians, and then what happens is you say to a judge, look, this person might possibly conceivably be dangerous while out on bail, and all defendants might possibly conceivably be dangerous while they're out on bail. So the judge says, well, sure, they might possibly conceivably be dangerous while they're out on bail. Why not just slap a third-party custodian requirement on them just to be safe? And I think that is the thought process that leads to the overuse of third-party custodians, which is incredibly burdensome. And I'm wondering, Barb, and I guess I would say that to the district attorneys out here too, or to the assistant attorney generals out here too, is there a tweak to the statute that governs third-party custodians and when they may be offered that we might consider that would be a reasonable tweak, not a radical tweak, but a minor tweak that might result in limiting the use of third-party custodians to really the more necessary cases? It's a rhetorical question, but if there is, please let me know, and we might consider incorporating it into this bill. Because I think if we can come up with a result where we use fewer third-party custodians, then in the long run, even if we change this to a misdemeanor from criminal contempt, I think everybody's probably better off. So I guess I would entertain language if people want to offer it.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I would just offer this observation. A lot of times the third-party custodian requirement is set by an arraigning magistrate before a prosecutor is involved in a case, when the person is taken to the magistrate right from the scene of arrest for an arraignment. And then what happens is, even though the Constitution of Alaska and the rules require a reasonable bail to be set within 24 hours, in actuality, a reasonable bail is not set because the person can't get out. A person who's brought to the magistrate and a third-party custodian and bail requirement is set, can't just post bail. He can't get out. In order to get out, he has to ask for a bail hearing, either propose that the third party be removed, which the next judge down the line is very loath to do, or to bring in a third party that's going to be approved. And so nobody has the ability to post reasonable bail immediately after their arrest. They always have to have a bail hearing. So the whole third party situation has greatly increased the workload of prosecutors, defense lawyers, and judges, because you have to have a bail hearing to get out. This initial setting of bail is sort of meaningless. And frankly, bail setting seems to be sort of in inverse proportion to the seriousness of the cases that the judges usually see. I mean, magistrates seem to set third-party requirements all the time, and in their day-to-day business, other than these arraignments, they handle the lowest level of serious offenses like traffic offenses. District court judges often set much harsher bail conditions, and they're used to seeing misdemeanor clients in cases, and superior court judges, frankly, seem to be the best at setting reasonable bail because they see the whole gamut of things. So when you're brought in for an arraignment in front of a magistrate who doesn't day-to-day handle very serious cases, it seems like it's almost automatic to get a third-party requirement.
Seems serious to them, probably.
Just one last follow-up.
Yeah, Representative Gere.
Thanks. I meant to suggest that maybe there should be some standard that you have to meet as a magistrate before you impose the third-party custodian requirement, some standard that maybe is a little more heightened than the standard we have today. That's what I was looking for.
Representative Gere, through the chair, the statute actually has a presumption of OR release, but it seems to mean nothing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's actually interesting. The only final point just to make on that, too, is just so that members are clear that the violation of the custodian is a failure to report immediately about a about the person for whom they are having custody over violation of their conditions of release. So just to be clear, it seems a minimal burden to pick up the phone and report immediately. Anyway, okay, we digress. Barbara, can you continue on, Representative Gruber?
On this point, since this, I mean, I realize we're taking witness by witness here, but I'm wondering, I'd like to hear from the court system on that point on, you know, how, who has the custodian. I wonder if we could ask, could we interrupt with Mr. Willover for a second?
You ready?
Just on this one point, since we seem to be focusing on that.
To the chair, for the record, my name is Doug Willover. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. You're fortunate that this Friday, the Judicial Council is going to be coming and reporting to your committee on its felony sentencing study. And a good portion of that talks about third-party custodians and the impact that it has on time spent in jail prior to conviction. And they have, in the respect that Barbara Brink is familiar with that study as a Department of Law, mm-hmm. and they have a great deal of information on that subject.
And I have a copy of that, but
I do too, I think, yes.
But we'll hear the full details. Great answer. Great answer. You should be a politician. All right. Barbara, keep walking us through. Sorry we're getting off on a rabbit trail there.
No, I think this is all good. The next section is section 13.
Okay.
Which has to do with the right of self-defense and frankly removes the right of self-defense to a whole class of people. I have great hesitation supporting this because I don't think these are questions that we can determine legislatively. Whether or not a person has a reasonable right of self-defense has traditionally in the American system of justice been left to the jury who can hear all the evidence. And removing this from a whole class of people engaged in fairly petty conduct actually seems inconsistent with Section 8 above that I mentioned. You know, in Section 8, we're starting to value the life of a participant in a felony who gets killed and making that a possibility to charge felony murder. Well, here it seems like we're removing the right of self-defense for whole classes of people. And I have a couple of examples, and I can also address the amendment that I know is before you because it tries to address this, but I don't think it addresses this adequately. I mean, in the current state of the bill, as it looks now, let's say a prostitute picked up a customer, and it turned out, which is not unheard of in Alaska, that he's a serial killer. This bill is telling her that she has no right to preserve her own life. let's say there's a couple of underage kids in a park sharing a beer, and they're attacked by some robber or mugger. We're telling those kids that their life is not worth protecting. You might think these hypotheticals are overdramatic, but these are instances that easily could be charged under this. What we're doing is we're sentencing people to death if they engage in petty criminal conduct. If somebody's driving with a license that's suspended and they get carjacked, there's a baby in the back seat of the car. Mother has no right to protect her child or herself because she's driving with suspended license.
Wow, I don't think that. Sorry, I didn't. You said sentenced to death.
Now, what we're saying is you don't have a right to defend yourself.
Yeah.
But what are we going to do if these people are attacked with deadly force and they do defend themselves? Well, we're going to convict them. We're not even going to let them bring to the jury the fact that they had a dangerous situation and it was their life or the other person's life at stake, because we're saying you have no right of self-defense. Their lawyer won't even get to ask the jury to consider that. And the examples can go on and on. What if there's a woman who has a restraining order out against a violent husband, and she's carrying concealed weapons in some place where it's prohibited or banned, like a university or a bank? Her husband, who has already posed a documented danger to her in the past, comes up and attacks her, and what we're telling her is she has no right to defend herself. She's charged. She may not be permitted to talk to the jury about his violent history, what he's done to her in the past, because he said to her, you cannot defend yourself. And even under the amendment that is being proposed, where we change it to felonious conduct, this doesn't take much to be a felony these days. If you're shoplifting something worth over $50, and in the last 5 years, you've shoplifted a pack of cigarettes and a carton of milk, you are facing a felony. And if some lunatic attacked you in the parking lot as you're fleeing this shoplifting, you may not defend yourself. This reminds me of the case in California where the three strikes law was drafted to cover all kinds of conduct. I'm certain that the drafters in California did not think that stealing three videos would subject you to a life sentence. But under this bill, if you steal three videos, and you have a prior conviction for a theft, that's over $50. Now, all of a sudden, you're not going to be permitted to defend yourself. And I just think that we're removing the power from the people. We're taking away a jury's right to listen to all the evidence about why someone engaged in self-defense.
Just throwing ideas out there, what if it were changed to say in those limited circumstances that the burden would shift to the defendant to argue it as an affirmative self-defense?
Madam Chair, that might be an improvement, but frankly, that's a difficult burden sometimes. I mean, this leads very well into my next section that I was going to talk about.
We're not ready for you to do that. Representative Samuels and then Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, if I go to a house and I'm there to buy a large quantity of drugs and I bring a gun and I know it's a dangerous situation, and somebody gets shot, do you think self-defense should be allowed in? Because that's a far more realistic situation than two kids sitting there drinking beer getting beat up by a serial killer.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, self-defense is a lot more complicated than that. What would have to be determined is whether the person who went there to buy drugs with a gun was the initial aggressor, because if he was the initial aggressor, the person in their own home, even if they're selling drugs, has a right to defend themselves. There's no duty to retreat in your own home. So I appreciate what you're saying, but self-defense is really complicated, and all I'm saying is that we should let the jury sort it out, because in that instance, no, I don't think the guy is justified if the person in the house doesn't do something to attack him or try to hurt him or kill him. But let's say the person in the house does do that. Why would we want to force this guy, just because he's going there to get drugs, to not be able to defend himself?
Well, here's another more realistic example. You got two cars full of kids driving down Northern Lights, shooting back and forth to each other, and nobody gets charged, even though somebody got killed because they both claimed self-defense. And that's a far more realistic than the two kids in the park again. And they're both, if you're
you bring a gun to a situation and you escalate it. And if it's a drug dealer, it's already escalated enough. And if it's not in somebody's house, let's say it's in a parking lot somewhere, and somebody gets shot. And those once again are far more realistic, real life scenarios. But I think that when the district attorney drafted this, or our department of law drafted this, that they were trying to cut those off the path.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels. I don't know whether I agree that those are very realistic, because frankly, in my two examples, like the ones that I've listed. But let's say that's true. Let's say there's two cars driving down Northern Lights, and all of a sudden one car starts firing on the other. We're telling the people in the second car because they fired back, they don't have a right to self-defense. I mean, Representative Samuels, the right of self-defense is inherent in every citizen's right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can we decide, before an event even takes place, that someone has forfeited their right by engaging in petty crime? And why would we want to do that? Wouldn't that encourage vigilantism to go on? Why don't we just, I mean, I just agree that those people can't be charged. They can be charged. Yes, it might be a more difficult case to prove. But why couldn't the jury figure that out? Why couldn't the jury, based on all the evidence and proof brought before them, decide who fired on who first and whether or not someone was justified? Why can't they make that decision?
So you're saying that we should just give the information, all the information, to the jury and let the jury hash it out?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I'll expect your support on HB 349. Thank you.
What's HB 349?
And with that, he wraps up.
In wrap up.
None of us know.
Closing arguments.
Ms. Brink, I don't think anybody except Representative Samuels knows.
The evidence rule, which didn't allow the defendant to get on the stand and lie, which the public defender testifies against, because they want to take that information away from the jury. So,
that's a very good point. Actually, that's a very good point. That's a very good point.
I don't understand.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll take the brunt of this instead of the public defenders. I think I opposed HB 349, and I don't consider myself completely dishonest. So I think there's actually a second side to the argument that I'm not going to bother making here.
That's equally obscure.
Will somebody speak English?
I'm going to leave that one to the side because
I do have a point, Representative Guerra, that you can say out loud.
Yeah, I do. I'm trying to say it politely, frankly, without insulting anybody. You know, there are circumstances where it's hard to prove somebody is guilty. There are two things we can do. Make it presumptive that guilty and innocent, that both guilty people and innocent people are guilty. That makes it really easy. You don't have to worry about hard proof problems. Or you can follow the sort of constitutional mandate that we've followed in this country that says, you know, sometimes proof is really hard to come by, but we're going to require it anyway. And we know when we do that, that benefits guilty people as well as innocent people. That's the fight that we have here all the time. But by taking away the right to self-defense from people who didn't do anything to deserve death, by taking away the right to self-defense from people who should, by all rights, be able to defend themselves just because we want to make it easier to prosecute people, I think is wrong. I understand your point, Representative Samuels. If we don't do this, there will be guilty people who go free. But if we do this, we are taking away the right to self-defense from somebody who, by all rights, should have that right to self-defense.
I'm going to offer an amendment just so that you guys know. I know that in the first version of the bill, we changed it to an affirmative defense, which is reflective of many states and federal. And this committee felt it went too far. Now you've come back with a narrowing of the circumstances, which I appreciate, because you're starting to hone in on the gang activity type cases. But what I think is important is that we do add back in the presumption. So I'm going to just throw that out there. I think that it probably goes too far to say you can't argue it at all. I do think that there may be that circumstance that someone does defend themselves, and I think that it ought to be something that the jury can factor in. That said, I think it's probably fair to say it can be a shift of the burden, and it's been done in other states and so on, but I think this, in my humble opinion, probably does go too far. But we can have that debate for another time.
Sure.
Representative Grunberg.
With that, assuming, and I'm asking Ms. Brink, then I'll ask Ms. Parks if I'm still here at some point, because I do have to go back 22, I'm sorry. The question really is, do either of you know whether courts have upheld the constitutionality of shifting the burden? And I'll ask Ms. Brink, since she's on the phone.
It has been. Barbara?
I'm sorry, through the chair, I don't know Representative Grunberg.
I would ask that question if I could for just a moment. Ms. Parks, do you know?
Yep. Yes, for the record, Susan Parks, for the Department of Law. Yes, other states, they have that currently in law, and it has been upheld in those other states, which is why the bill last year was drafted that way, because we believe it is constitutional, and that's why it was drafted that way last year.
Please sit. You're welcome to sit. You don't have to crouch.
Join us.
All right, not to.
They come, they crouch, and they leave.
No, I won't be like Doug.
Sounds like the title of a movie. A bad movie.
Let me ask the opposite question. Are either of you aware of any states where it has not been upheld?
I'm not aware of any, but I defer to Ms. Carbonetti whether you came across any states where it had been made an affirmative defense and been found unconstitutional.
Unconstitutional?
Uh-huh.
I don't recall that I have, but it has been found constitutional, I believe, in the United States Supreme Court case, Matt versus Ohio, I believe, but I haven't.
Like, Matt versus Ohio? I thought that was a search and seizure.
Maybe I'm mistaken. I will bring it to you. It's an Ohio case, and I'm remembering Matt because it's a common case, but
not Brandenburg either. I know it wasn't Brandenburg.
Okay, so we'll await that. All right, please stay up here with us, Susan, because we'll have more questions. Barbara, will you continue on? We had just talked about the self-defense section 13.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll continue. I just wanted to mention one other item about section 13, which is I don't really understand what a transaction or purported transaction. I don't really understand what purported is, and frankly, I'm even more confused if we change this to an affirmative defense, because I don't really understand who's going to have the burden of proving what. Is the defendant going to have to prove that he was not in a purported transaction? Is he going to have to prove that he was not acting to further the criminal objectives of one or more persons? I just think the purported language is very vague. All someone has to do is claim somebody was trying to sell them drugs, and then that person has forfeited their right to self-defense. I have problems with that section, but I'm moving on to section 14.
And just so that you know, your comments on that are noted, and we do have a couple of amendments out there to try to better define the type of activity that we're talking about in section 4, and the committee will work on that, and we do, and I at least agree with you that there's a bit of vagueness there, so stay tuned, I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 14 still talks about self-defense, but finds that the court may only instruct a jury about self-defense if it finds that there is, quote, some plausible evidence instead of any evidence regarding self-defense. And, you know, currently, the jury and the judge have two really different roles in a trial. The judge decides what evidence is admissible, and as Representative Sanders pointed out, those questions include whether or not that evidence is legally obtained, whether it's relevant to prove some issue in that particular case, and whether or not that evidence is too prejudicial to one side or the other. So the judge often hears evidence in advance of the jury to rule on its admissibility. The jury decides what weight to give that evidence. The jury decides whether evidence is plausible or credible or believable or not. And under this section in 14, we're taking away that power from the jury, from us, the people, and giving it to the judge. and I don't really understand why. We don't make the judge the finder of fact in a jury trial. You have a right to have a jury trial. You have a right to have 12 of your peers determine whether or not your self-defense was plausible. And what self-respecting jury would find self-defense when evidence was implausible? So if it's admissible, I say we ought to let the jury decide.
Madam Chair?
Representative Gruenberg?
We talked about this, Ms. Parks, Ms. Carpinetti, and myself, and I was informed, and correct me, folks, if I'm wrong, that this is a very low standard, and it's the standard of the Court of Appeals. Am I not correct on this? Is that right?
The standard of self-defense?
Plausible.
Well, the word plausible, as I understand it, was used because right now the Court of Appeals says any evidence, even if implausible, raises self-defense and the defendant gets the instruction. And so we're trying to make the level of evidence a little higher.
Yeah, well, I'm reminded of a conversation. And you folks, through the chair, were going to get me the cases where the implausible language, quote implausible language, appears. Did you ever do that? Do I have that?
I gave it to Ken and your aide.
Okay, do you remember that? Which case? Because I seem to have quite a file here.
I hesitate to say because I'm afraid I could use the wrong name. But I can give it to you.
It did not involve the state of Ohio, I think.
No, these are less state cases.
I know. Okay, well, that would be helpful. Because as I understand it, the conversation, I'm trying to reconstruct, the question was whether it was dictum or a holding, and I don't remember what the answer to that was, or whether it was known.
Without
we don't even answer right now, but at some point, before we proceed to mark this bill, I'd like to know.
Thanks. I would just offer this out for the committee. There seems to be an undercurrent here that we don't want the self-defense defense to be used in cases where it's really a frivolous claim. And so I think that was the attempt, frankly, in Section 13. But Section 13 is written in a way that bothers many of us. And I wonder whether if we adopt Section 14, we don't need to deal with Section 13, if we can just dump it. And here you have this gatekeeper standard that says, you know, if it's plausible, let the jury hear about it. And we don't have to go through the whole process of adopting this sort of really loose or more troublesome standard that's in Section 13. I wonder if that might be the way to deal with it.
May I respond to that?
Representative Gruber?
Thank you. I think, and I like, at first I liked what you were saying, Representative Guerra, but I think it's not necessarily, there are two different issues. One issue is whether there's a plausible question of fact. The other is whether it's possible to determine, it's not whether it's plausible, but whether it's susceptible of determination. It's like saying, we know a crime has been committed, but we can't tell who committed it. Here, we know there's been a shooting, but we can't tell whether there's been a self-defense. It's impossible to determine. Now, I'm not saying that I think that's a reason for doing what you're saying here to the Attorney General. But I am saying, I think analytically, the issues are a little different.
Let's keep that in the back of our minds here and keep moving forward if that's okay. But I hear what you're saying. Barbara, what are we to section?
15 through 17.
Okay.
Provisions that have to do with immunity for witnesses.
Yep.
I also understand that there has been an amendment proposed.
Yes, I have that.
Yep.
Limit the information given to the prosecutor's office, just a different level of higher level, lower level, or a misdemeanor.
Yep. That's correct.
Excuse me, apparently we've also submitted a proposed affidavit I mean, a proposed amendment that would simply end section I after the word finding on page 9, line 29 and 30.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we're giving this to Vanessa now.
The procedures portion of it.
Section I, period after finding.
And it involves some other deletions that have been forwarded as well.
Madam Chair, I don't have any problem with the sections that can also be in section 16. I don't have any problems with the sections that clarify the statute and make our statute conform to the decision in Gonzales versus State, where the Alaska Supreme Court held that our right to privilege against self-incrimination requires any finding of immunity to be transactional immunity, not just use and derivative use immunity. So the state of Alaska clearly has a higher standard, and both parts of the statute that clarify that in conformity with that case are fine. But I have a terrible problem with the section that allows or requires the judge, after proffer by a person who's exercising that privilege, share information about what was said during this ex parte hearing, where the judge has found this witness has a valid claim of Fifth Amendment privilege. They have an absolute right not to testify. They have an absolute right not to give any information regarding their involvement. Then we're telling the judge that he must tell the prosecutor what level of offense involved in. I think, and I'm sure that that is a link in the chain, tying them to the crime and under transactional immunity, that's unconstitutional. I don't think you can fix that part. I think the only way you can make the statute constitutional is to remove that proffer from the judge to the DA's office. I realize the DAs are frustrated. They would like to know what that person is involved in. Like to know that before making a decision to grant them immunity. The privilege is absolute and it cannot be breached. And I think if you include that information going from the court to the DA, that's rendered that section unconstitutional.
May I inquire?
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Do you have any authority to support that proposition, or has any state ever adopted such a provision? And I would certainly ask the state the same question. Do either of you have any authority on one side or the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunberg, my authority is the case itself, Gonzales versus State, which is at 853 P. Second 526. And what they say in that on page, I'm having a hard time finding the page here, at 777 is, in Alaska, the privilege against self-incrimination applies where the answers elicited could support a conviction or might furnish a link in the chain of evidence leading to a conviction.
And your position is that this is a link?
Correct.
I would ask, Madam Chair, would the prosecution care to respond to that?
I would, Madam Chair, if I might. We have not found any state that has a provision like this, but there are very few states, it's my understanding, that require transactional immunity. So most states, this is based on an interpretation of the Alaska state constitution. This is not a federal requirement. It's under our constitution, and so we're in the minority, as I understand it, requiring transactional immunity. I disagree with Ms. Brink. I've read Gonzales. We've had our attorneys who are much smarter than me read Gonzales, and we do not believe that this is unconstitutional. Under Gonzales, Gonzales is the case that declared that we must have transactional immunity. It was discussing actually forcing someone to take the stand and give testimony that anything that they say on the stand could be a link in the chain. We are prepared to litigate whether this is constitutional or not. This is a very minimal request on the part of prosecutors in terms of exercising what is an extremely powerful tool, and that is immunity. It's a very dangerous thing to give to someone with absolutely no information, which is what we're required to do now. So I do not believe it's unconstitutional under Gonzales, and I
personally, I think this is one of the most important parts of this bill for me personally, because I have to approve any request for immunity as Deputy Attorney General because of the ramifications. If you give immunity to the wrong person in the wrong circumstances, I'm the only person who can give that immunity. To me, this is the most important piece of this legislation.
Madam Chair, Ms. Brink, I have this. This is the State v. Gonzalez, 853-526.
Yes.
Okay, what page were you reading from?
Well, I have the internet version, so it's on page 4, but it looks to me like that is on page
13. I have the internet version, too. Okay, I'm looking at page 4.
Right at headnote 7?
Headnote 7.
First column, about a quarter of the way down.
Okay, Representative Guerra.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I sort of suspected that the prosecution and the defense would have different views of Gonzalez, and I thought that maybe we could have Mr. Wolliver tell us how the, how the courts would rule.
Don't
you don't have to answer that question. I instructed you not to.
You don't have immunity.
Yeah, you don't have immunity.
Okay, Ms. Madam Chair.
Representative Grover.
Okay, what they're reading is, and I'm going to read you the whole thing here. In the present case, our inquiry is controlled by Alaska precedent. The state in DeGrasse acknowledged that the scope of Article 1, Section 9, that's of the Alaska Constitution, is set forth in ELL v. State, 572 P. 2nd, 786, the 1977 case, and they're quoting from the ELL case here. The privilege against self-incrimination applies where the answer is elicited, could support a conviction, or might furnish a link in the chain of evidence leading to a conviction. But a witness may not refuse to testify where there is no real or substantial hazard of incrimination. Now, I'm going to ask Ms. Park's question here.
Vanessa's making copies of the case again.
Okay. Now,
we all decided you should have been a law school professor.
Oh, give me a break. The question really, seriously, is, Ms. Park, is your objection based on the fact that you do not believe that is the law, or on the other hand, that this is not a link in the chain?
Through the chair, it clearly is the law, but I do not believe what we are requesting the court, the judge to tell us would be a link in the chain.
Okay. Yeah. Ms. Brink, why do you believe this is a link?
Because, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, because the idea is that the person who has a valid Fifth Amendment right must be kept in the same position as if he remains silent. Okay, so the standard is the same position if he remains silent. This is not the same position. This is giving the state information about the crime, about the type of crime, about the level of crime, from his own words. If he had remained silent, he would have faced no hazards of incrimination from his own words. And there is a second basis to the Gonzalez opinion. It says that the court and the state cannot safeguard against the non-evidentiary use of compelled testimony. And non-evidentiary use means what's to prevent law enforcement or the DA's office from focusing the investigation, deciding to initiate a prosecution, refusing to plea bargaining, or interpreting evidence, or planning a cross-examine, or somehow otherwise planning trial strategy. And Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that's on page 532 of the court decision and page 5 of the internet decision. And I would like to point out one more thing. The state of Alaska prosecutor's office argued extremely strongly in this case that our statute, which only provided use and derivative use immunity, was constitutional. And they were wrong about that. The Supreme Court held that the statute, the very statute that you're fixing now, and that they supported, was unconstitutional if it only provided use and derivative use. So that question of constitutionality was resolved against the state.
Okay, Madam Chair, if I may, just briefly.
Briefly.
This is at the bottom of page 531 and 532. The issue is whether the state could, quote, meaningfully safeguard against non-evidentiary use of, and I'm going to say this, compelled testimony. If that is the standard, and I'm looking at Ms. Parks, what guarantees could the state offer if we were to adopt subsection I in this bill? Because it seems to me that if you get the information here that clearly does provide some vicariously provided testimony from the defendant in camera, it comes from in camera to the judge to you, what assurance is there that there would be, that this would be meaningfully safeguarded? Because, you know, it seems to me that if that information is provided to you, then you could use it.
Through the chair. It's information, it's not testimony. I mean, that's my first position, is that this is not testimony. This is just a judge letting us know the level of offenses, and not even the specific level that we're looking at. Two, so I don't think we're getting much information. I don't consider it evidence to be given that level of information. What seems to be being implied here is that we're in an investigative stage of a case, and we're not. What we're talking about is when someone's been charged, we're trying to go to trial, we've made a charging decision, we've done our investigation, we're trying to get a witness on the stand to give evidence. And so I think the concerns that we're somehow going to be using this information to now focus on the person we're trying to get to testify, I think we're far afield of what would really happen.
May I ask one?
Representative Kroenberg.
The first, that this is not testimony, frankly, I can't buy that, because the way the judge learned it was from the defendant's mouth, or from the attorney's mouth on behalf of the defendant in chambers. It clearly was testimonial at that point. Secondly, if you're saying that you're focusing on whether to get this person to testify, that's great, but the court here is talking about whether you, the state, can provide an assurance it won't be used against that person. And that's the crux. I don't need an answer now. But if you want something like this, I think to meet the standard of Gonzales, you have to have a meaningful safeguard that the words, the information you obtain, are not going to be used against that person. Can you say anything to that?
I guess through the chair, I mean, to say that the information given by the judge fruits of that poisonous tree, some kind of language that would say it would be suppressed, couldn't be used, couldn't be pursued, I wouldn't be opposed to that kind of language, because frankly I don't see it being particularly useful in an investigation.
Maybe we're getting, I don't know, but this, if you can go and focus on that, that may help us to a solution.
Because Susan, the way it is right now, if there's a witness that you want to put up and they claim immunity, go and meet with the judge, I mean, you really are in a position where it could be for something very, very serious. And I'm sure that there's probably even a case of somebody that would maybe even want to be a witness because they could get immunity for something like that. Or at a minimum, you're granting immunity for something very, very serious when you could have found another witness or you could have let that part go. That's really the rub, isn't it?
Madam Chair, that's exactly the concern, is that you give immunity to the wrong person because you do it blindly, and yeah, someone's going to get up there and confess to a homicide, and you've given them transactional immunity
you're done. You can't prosecute it.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to avoid. And I just would like to point out that many, many times we work with witnesses and work these things out where they tell us what their concerns are. We know what the crime is that they're concerned about, drug use or something like that, and we do give immunity in these cases. These are cases where the witness is uncooperative with us. Sometimes they are afraid to testify. They've been intimidated by the defendant. They're friends with the defendant, want to protect them. Those are the kind of cases often where this is coming up, and then we lose very valuable evidence in a serious case.
Yeah, yeah. Representative Guerra.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly have no idea.